Never made it to South America.
Is that where the Andes are? All this time I thought they were in Florida. She laughed again. And Bosch felt good about successfully changing the subject. He liked looking at her teeth when she laughed. They were just a little bit crooked and in a way that made them perfect. So, seriously, what did you do? She turned in the stool so they were shoulder to shoulder, looking at each other in the mirror behind all the colored bottles lined along the back wall of the bar. Oh, I was a lawyer for a while. Not a defense lawyer, so don't get excited. Civil law. Then I realized that was bullshit and quit and just started traveling. I worked along the way. I made pottery in Venice, Italy. I was a horse guide in the Swiss Alps for a while. I was cook on a day trip tourist boat in Hawaii. I did other things, and I just saw a lot of the world. Except for the Andes. Then I came home. To L.A.? Born and raised. You? Same. Queen of Angels. Cedars. She held out her glass and they clinked. To the few, the proud, the brave, she said. Bosch finished off his glass and poured in the contents of his sidecar. He was way ahead of Brasher, but didn't care. He was feeling relaxed. It was good to forget about things for a while. It was good to be with somebody not directly related to the case. Born at Cedars, huh? He asked. Where'd you grow up? Don't laugh. Bel Air. Bel Air? I guess somebody's daddy isn't too happy about her joining the cops. Especially since his was the law firm she walked out of one day and wasn't heard from for 2 years. Bosch smiled and raised his glass. She clicked hers off it. Brave girl. After they put their glasses down, she said, Let's stop all the questions. Okay, Bosch said. And do what? Just take me home, Harry. To your place. He paused for a moment, looking at her shiny blue eyes. Things were moving lightning fast, greased on the smooth runners of alcohol. But that was often the way it was between cops, between people who felt they were part of a closed society, who lived by their instincts and went to work each day knowing that how they made their living could kill them. Yeah, he finally said. I was just thinking the same thing. He leaned over and kissed her on the mouth. Chapter 11. Julia Brasher stood in the living room of Bosch's house and looked at the CDs stored in the racks next to the stereo.
I love jazz.
Bosch was in the kitchen. He smiled when he heard her say it. He finished pouring two martinis out of a shaker and came out to the living room and handed her a glass. Who do you like?
Lately, Bill Evans.
Bosch nodded, went to the rack, and came up with Kind of Blue. He loaded it into the stereo. Bill and Miles, he said. Not to mention Coltrane and a few other guys. Nothing better. As the music began, he picked up his martini and she came over and tapped it with her glass. Rather than drink, they kissed each other. She started laughing halfway through the kiss. What? He said.
Nothing. I'm just feeling reckless. And happy.
Yeah, me too.
I think it was you giving me the flashlight.
Bosch was puzzled. What do you mean?
You know. It's so phallic.
The look on Bosch's face made her laugh again, and she spilled some of her drink on the floor. Later, when she was lying face down on his bed, Bosch was tracing the outline of the flaming sun tattooed on the small of her back and thinking about how comfortable and yet strange she felt to him. He knew almost nothing about her. Like the tattoo, there seemed to be a surprise from every angle of view he had on her.
"What are you thinking about?" she asked.
"Nothing. Just wondering about the guy who got to put this on your back. I wish it had been me, I guess."
"How come?"
"Because there will always be a piece of him with you." She turned on her side, revealing her breasts and her smile. Her hair was out of its braid and down around her shoulders. He liked that, too. She reached up and pulled him down into a long kiss. Then she said, "That's the nicest thing that's been said to me in a long time." He put his head down on her pillow. He could smell the sweet scent of perfume and sex and sweat.
"You don't have any pictures on your wall," she said.
"Photos, I mean." He shrugged his shoulders. She turned over so her back was to him. He reached under her arm and cupped one of her breasts and pulled her back into him. "Can you stay till the morning?" he asked.
"Well, my husband will probably wonder where I am, but I guess I could call him."
Bosch froze. Then she started laughing. "Don't scare me like that."
"Well, you never even asked me if I was involved with anyone."
"You didn't ask me."
"You were obvious. The lone detective type."
And then, in a deep male voice,
"Just the facts, ma'am. No time for dames. Murder is my business. I have a job to do and I am..."
He ran his thumb down her side, over the indentations of her ribs. She cut off her words with laughter. "You lent me your flashlight," he said. "I didn't think an involved woman would have done that."
"And I've got news for you, tough guy. I saw the mag in your trunk. In the box before you covered it up. You weren't fooling anybody."
Bosch rolled back on the other pillow, embarrassed. He could feel his face getting red. He brought his hands up to hide it.
"Oh, God. Mr. Obvious."
She rolled over to him and peeled back his hands. She kissed him on the chin.
"I thought it was nice. Kind of made my day and gave me something to maybe look forward to."
She turned his hands back and looked at the scarring across the knuckles. They were old marks and not very noticeable anymore.
"Hey, what is this?"
"Just scars."
"I know that. From what?"
"I had tattoos. I took them off. It was a long time ago."
"How come?"
"They made me take them off when I went into the army." She started to laugh.
"Why? What did it say? Fuck the army or something?"
"No, nothing like that."
"Well, then what? Come on, I want to know."
"It said H-O-L-D on one hand and F-A-S-T on the other."
"Hold fast? What does hold fast mean?"
"Well, it's kind of a long story."
"I have time. My husband doesn't mind."
She smiled.
"Come on, I want to know."
"It's not a big deal. When I was a kid, one of the times I ran away, I ended up down in San Pedro, down around the fishing docks. And a lot of those guys down there, the fishermen, the tuna guys, I saw they had this on their hands. Hold fast. And I asked one of them about it, and he told me it was like their motto, their philosophy. It's like when they were out there in those boats, way out there for weeks, and the waves got huge and it got scary, you just had to grab on and hold fast." Bosch made two fists and held them up. "Hold fast to life. To everything that you have."
"So you had it done. How old were you?"
"I don't know. 16, thereabouts." He nodded and then he smiled. What I didn't know was that those tuna guys got it from some Navy guys. So, a year later, I go waltzing into the Army with Hold Fast on my hands, and the first thing my sergeant told me was to get rid of it. He wasn't going to have any squid tattoo on one of his guy's hands. She grabbed his hands and looked closely at the knuckles. This doesn't look like laser work. Boss shook his head. They didn't have lasers back then. So what did you do? My sergeant, his name was Rosser, took me out of the barracks and over to the back of the administration building. There was a brick wall. He made me punch it, until every one of my knuckles was cut up. Then, after they were scabbed up in about a week, he made me do it again.
Jesus fucking Christ, that's barbaric.
No, that's the Army. He smiled at the memory. It wasn't as bad as it sounded. He looked down at his hands. The music stopped and he got up and walked through the house naked to change it. When he came back to the bedroom, she recognized the music. Clifford Brown? He nodded and came toward the bed. He didn't think he had ever known a woman who could identify jazz music like that.
Stand there.
What?
Let me look at you. Tell me about those other scars.
The room was dimly lit by a light from the bathroom, but Bosch became conscious of his nakedness. He was in good shape, but he was more than 15 years older than her. He wondered if she had ever been with a man so old.
Harry, you look great. You totally turned me on, okay? What about the other scars?
He touched the thick rope of skin above his left hip. This? This was a knife.
Where'd that happen?
A tunnel.
And your shoulder?
Bullet.
Where?
He smiled. A tunnel.
Ouch. Stay out of tunnels.
I try. He got into the bed and pulled the sheet up. She touched his shoulder, running her thumb over the thick skin of the scar.
Right in the bone, she said.
Yeah. I got lucky. No permanent damage. It aches in the winter, and when it rains, that's about it.
What did it feel like? Being shot, I mean.
Bosch shrugged his shoulders. It hurt like hell, and then everything sort of went numb.
How long were you down?
About 3 months.
You didn't get a disability out?
It was offered. I declined.
How come?
I don't know. I liked the job, I guess. And I thought that if I stuck with it, someday I'd meet this beautiful young cop who'd be impressed by all my scars. She jammed him in the ribs, and the pain made him grimace.
Oh, poor baby.
She said in a mocking voice. That hurt. She touched the tattoo on his shoulder.
What's that supposed to be? Mickey Mouse on acid?
Sort of. It's a tunnel rat. Her face lost all trace of humor. What's the matter?
You were in Vietnam, she said, putting things together. I've been in those tunnels.
What do you mean?
When I was on the road, I spent 6 weeks in Vietnam. The tunnels, they're like a tourist thing now. You pay your money and you can go down into them. It must have been... What you had to do must have been so frightening.
It was more scary afterward, thinking about it.
They have them roped off so they can sort of control where you go. But nobody really watches you. So I went under the rope and went further in. It got so dark in there, Harry.
Bosch studied her eyes. And did you see it? He asked quietly. The lost light? She held his eyes for a moment and nodded.
I saw it. My eyes adjusted and there was light. Almost like a whisper. but it was enough for me to find my way.
Lost light. We called it lost light. We never knew where it came from, but it was down there, like smoke hanging in the dark. Some people said it wasn't light, that it was the ghosts of everybody who died in those things. From both sides. They spoke no more after that. They held each other, and soon she was asleep. Bosch realized he had not thought about the case for more than 3 hours. At first, this made him feel guilty. But then he let it go, and soon he too was asleep. He dreamed he was moving through a tunnel. But he wasn't crawling. It was as if he were underwater and moving like an eel through the labyrinth. He came to a dead end, and there was a boy sitting against the curve of the tunnel's wall. He had his knees up and his face down, buried in his folded arms. "Come with me," Bosch said. The boy peeked his eyes over one arm and looked up at Bosch. A single bubble of air rose from his mouth. He then looked past Bosch as if something was coming up behind him. Bosch turned around, but there was only the darkness of the tunnel behind him. When he looked back at the boy, he was gone. Chapter 12. Late Sunday morning, Bosch drove Brasher to the Hollywood station so she could get her car and he could resume work on the case. She was off duty Sundays and Mondays. They made plans to meet at her house in Venice that night for dinner. There were other officers in the parking lot when Bosch dropped her next to her car. Bosch knew that word would get around quickly that it appeared they had spent the night together. "I'm sorry," he said. "I should have thought it out better last night."
"I don't really care, Harry. I'll see you tonight."
"Hey, look, you should care. Cops can be brutal." She made a face.
"Oh, police brutality, yeah. I've heard of it."
"I'm serious. It's also against regs, on my part. I'm a D3, supervisor level." She looked at him a moment.
"Well, that's your call, then. I'll see you tonight. I hope."
She got out and closed the door. Bosch drove on to his assigned parking slot and went into the detective bureau, trying not to think of the complications he might have just invited into his life. It was deserted in the squad room, which was what he was hoping for. He wanted time alone with the case. There was still a lot of office work to do, but he also wanted to step back and think about all the evidence and information that had been accumulated since the discovery of the bones. The first thing to do was put together a list of what needed to be done. The murder book, the blue binder containing all written reports pertaining to the case, had to be completed. He had to draw up search warrants seeking medical records of brain surgeries at local hospitals. He had to run routine computer checks on all the residents living in the vicinity of the crime scene on Wonderland. He also had to read through all the call-in tips spawned by the media coverage of the bones on the hill and start gathering missing person and runaway reports that might match the victim. He knew it was more than a day's work if he labored by himself, but decided to keep with his decision to allow Edgar the day off. His partner, the father of a 13-year-old boy, had been greatly upset by Gallagher's report the day before, and Bosch wanted him to take a break. The days ahead would likely be long and just as emotionally upsetting. Once Bosch had his list together, he took his cup out of a drawer and went back to the watch office to get coffee. The smallest he had on him was a $5 bill, but he put it in the coffee fund basket without taking any change. He figured he'd be drinking more than his share through the day. "You know what they say," someone said behind him as he was filling the cup. Bosch turned. It was Mankiewicz, the watch sergeant. "About what?"
"Fishing off the company dock."
"I don't know. What do they say?"
"I don't know either. That's why I was asking you."
Mankiewicz smiled and moved toward the machine to warm up his cup.
So, already it was starting to get around, Bosch thought. Gossip and innuendo, especially anything with a sexual tone, moved through a police station like a fire racing up a hill in August. Well, let me know when you find out, Bosch said as he started for the door of the watch office. Could be useful to know.
Will do.
Oh, and one other thing, Harry. Bosch turned, ready for another shot for Mankiewicz. What? Just stop fooling around and wrap up your case. I'm tired of my guys having to take all the calls. There was a facetious tone in his voice. In his humor and sarcasm was a legitimate complaint about his officers on the desk being tied up by the tip calls. Yeah, I know. Any good ones today? Not that I could tell, but you'll get to slog through the reports and use your investigative wiles to decide that. Wiles?
Yes, wiles. Like Wile E. Coyote. Oh, and CNN must have had a slow morning and picked up the story. Good video. All you brave guys on the hill with your makeshift stairs and little boxes of bones. So now we're getting the long-distance calls. Topeka and Providence so far this morning. It's not going to end until you clear it, Harry. We're all counting on you back here.
Again, there was a smile and a message behind what he was saying. All right, I'll use all my wiles, I promise, Mank.
That's what we're counting on.
Back at the table, Bosch sipped his coffee and let the details of the case move through his mind. There were anomalies. Contradictions. There were the conflicts between location choice and method of burial noticed by Kathy Cole. But the conclusions made by Gallagher added even more to the list of questions. Gallagher saw it as a child abuse case. But the backpack full of clothes was an indication that the victim, the boy, was possibly a runaway. Bosch had spoken to Edgar about it the day before when they returned to the station from the SID lab. His partner was not as sure of the conflict as Bosch, but offered a theory that perhaps the boy was the victim of child abuse both at the hands of his parents and then an unrelated killer. He rightfully pointed out that many victims of abuse run away only to be drawn into another form of abusive relationship. Bosch knew the theory was legitimate, but tried not to let himself go down that road because he knew it was even more depressing than the scenario Gallagher had spun. His direct line rang and Bosch answered, expecting it to be Edgar or Lieutenant Billets checking in. It was a reporter from the L.A. Times named Josh Meyer. Bosch barely knew him and was sure he'd never given him the direct line. He didn't let on that he was annoyed, however. Though tempted to tell the reporter that the police were running down leads extending as far as Topeka and Providence, he simply said there was no further update on the investigation since Friday's briefing from the media relations office. After he hung up, he finished his first cup of coffee and got down to work. The part of an investigation Bosch enjoyed the least was the computer work. Whenever possible, he gave it to his partners to handle, so he decided to put the computer runs at the end of his list and started with a quick look through the accumulated tip sheets from the watch office. There were about 36 more sheets since he had last looked through the pile on Friday. None contained enough information to be helpful or worth pursuing at the moment. Each was from a parent or sibling or friend of someone who had disappeared, all of them permanently forlorn and seeking some kind of closure to the most pressing mystery of their lives. He thought of something and rolled his chair over to one of the old IBM Selectrics. He inserted a sheet of paper and typed out 4 questions. Do you know if your missing loved one underwent any kind of surgical procedure in the months before his disappearance? If so, what hospital was he treated at? What was the injury? What was the name of his physician? He rolled the page out and took it to the watch office. He gave it to Mankiewicz to be used as a template of questions to be asked of all callers about the bones. That wily enough for you? Bosch asked.
No, but it's a start.
While he was there, Bosch took a plastic cup and filled it with coffee, and then came back to the bureau and dumped it into his cup.
He made a note to ask Lieutenant Billets on Monday to procure some help in contacting all the callers of the last few days to ask the same medical questions. He then thought of Julia Brasher. He knew she was off on Mondays and would volunteer if needed. But he quickly dismissed it, knowing that by Monday the whole station would know about them, and bringing her into the case would make matters worse. He started the search warrants next. It was a matter of routine in homicide work to need medical records in the course of an investigation. Most often these records came from physicians and dentists, but hospitals were not unusual. Bosch kept a file with search warrant templates for hospitals as well as a listing of all 29 hospitals in the Los Angeles area and the attorneys who handled legal filings at each location. Having all of this handy allowed him to draw up 29 search warrants in a little over an hour. The warrants sought the records of all male patients under the age of 16 who underwent brain surgery entailing the use of a trephine drill between 1975 and 1985. After printing out the requests, he put them in his briefcase. While normally it was proper on a weekend to fax a search warrant to a judge's home for approval and signature, it would certainly not be acceptable to fax 29 requests to a judge on a Sunday afternoon. Besides, the hospital lawyers would not be available on a Sunday anyway. Bosch's plan was to take the warrants to a judge first thing Monday morning, then divide them with Edgar and hand-deliver them to the hospitals, thereby being able to push the urgency of the matter with the lawyers in person. Even if things went according to plan, Bosch didn't expect to start receiving returns of records from the hospitals until midweek or later. Bosch next typed out a daily case summary as well as a recap of the anthropological information from Gallagher. He put these in the murder book and then typed up an evidence report detailing the preliminary SID findings on the backpack. When he was finished, Bosch leaned back and thought about the unreadable letter that had been found in the backpack. He did not anticipate that the documents section would have any success with it. It would forever be the mystery shrouded in the mystery of the case. He gulped the last of his second cup of coffee and opened the murder book to the page containing a copy of the crime scene sketch and chart. He studied the chart and noted that the backpack had been found right next to the spot Cole had marked as the probable original location of the body. Bosch wasn't sure what it all meant, but instinctively he knew that the questions he now had about the case should be kept foremost in his mind as new evidence and details continued to be gathered. They would be the screen through which everything would be sifted. He put the report into the murder book and then finished the updating of the paperwork by bringing the investigator's log, an hour-by-hour time chart with small entry blocks, up to date. He then put the murder book in his briefcase. Bosch took his coffee cup to the sink in the restroom and washed it out. He then returned it to its drawer, picked up his briefcase, and headed out the back door to his car. Chapter 13. The basement of Parker Center, the headquarters of the Los Angeles Police Department, serves as the record archives for every case the department has taken a report on in the modern era. Until the mid-90s, records were kept on paper for a period of 8 years and then transferred to microfiche for permanent storage. The department now used computers for permanent storage and was also moving backward, putting older files into digital storage banks. But the process was slow and had not gone further back than the late 80s. Bosch arrived at the counter in archives at 1 o'clock. He had 2 containers of coffee with him and 2 roast beef sandwiches from Philippe's in a paper bag. He looked at the clerk and smiled. "Believe it or not, I need to see the fiche on missing person reports, 1975 to 85. The clerk, an old guy with a basement pallor, whistled and said, "Look out, Christine, here they come." Bosch smiled and nodded. I didn't know what the man was talking about. There appeared to be no one else behind the counter. "The good news is they break up," the clerk said. "I mean, I think it's good news. Are you looking for adult or juvie records?" "Juveniles. then that cuts it up a bit. Thanks. Don't mention it.
The clerk disappeared from the counter and Bosch waited. In 4 minutes, the man came back with 10 small envelopes containing microfiche sheets for the years Bosch requested. Altogether, the stack was at least 4 inches thick. Bosch went to a microfiche reader and copier, set out a sandwich and the two coffees, and took the second sandwich back to the counter. The clerk refused the first offer, but then took the sandwich when Bosch said it was from Philippe's. Bosch went back to the machine and started fiching, wading first into the year 1985. He was looking for missing person and runaway reports of young males in the age range of the victim. Once he got proficient with the machine, he was able to move quickly through the reports. He would scan first for the closed stamp that indicated the missing individual had returned home or been located. If there was no stamp, his eyes would immediately go to the age and sex boxes on the form. If they fit the profile of his victim, he'd read the summary and then push the photocopy button on the machine to get a hard copy to take with him. The microfiche also contained records of missing person reports forwarded to the LAPD by outside agencies, seeking people believed to have gone to Los Angeles. Despite his speed at the task, it took Bosch more than 3 hours to go through all the reports for the 10 years he had requested. He had hard copies of more than 300 reports in the tray to the side of the machine when he was finished, and he had no idea whether his effort had been worth the time or not. Bosch rubbed his eyes and pinched the bridge of his nose. He had a headache from staring at the machine's screen and reading tale after tale of parental anguish and juvenile angst. He looked over and realized he hadn't eaten his sandwich. He returned the stack of microfiche envelopes to the clerk and decided to do the computer work in Parker Center rather than drive back to Hollywood. From Parker Center, he could jump on the 10 freeway and shoot out to Venice for dinner at Julia Brasher's house. It would be easier. The squad room of the robbery-homicide division was empty except for the two on-call detectives who were sitting in front of a television watching a football game. One of them was Bosch's former partner, Kismin Ryder. The other, Bosch didn't recognize. Ryder stood up smiling when she saw it was Bosch.
"Harry, what are you doing here?" she asked.
"Working a case. I want to use a computer. That all right?"
"That bone thing?"
He nodded.
"I heard about it on the news. Harry, this is Rick Thornton, my partner."
Bosch shook his hand and introduced himself.
"I hope she makes you look as good as she did me."
Thornton just nodded and smiled, and Ryder looked embarrassed.
"Come on over to my desk," she said. "You can use my computer."
She showed him the way and let him sit in her seat.
"We're just twiddling our thumbs here. Nothing happening. I don't even like football."
"Don't complain about the slow days. Didn't anybody ever tell you that?"
"Yeah, my old partner. Only thing he ever said that made any sense."
"I bet.
Anything I can do to help?"
"I'm just running the names. The usual."
He opened his briefcase and took out the murder book. He opened it to a page where he had listed the names, addresses, and birth dates of residents on Wonderland Avenue who had been interviewed during the neighborhood canvass. It was a matter of routine and due diligence to run the name of every person investigators came across in an investigation.
"You want a coffee or something?" Ryder asked.
"Nah, I'm fine. Thanks, kids."
He nodded in the direction of Thornton, who had his back to them and was on the other side of the room.
"How are things going?"
She shrugged her shoulders.
"Every now and then he lets me do some real detective work," she said in a whisper.
"Well, you can always come back to Hollywood," he whispered back with a smile.
He started typing in the commands for entering the National Crime Index computer. Immediately, Ryder made a sound of derision.
"Harry, you're still typing with two fingers?"
"It's all I know, kids. I've been doing it this way for almost 30 years. You expect me to suddenly know how to type with 10 fingers? I'm still not fluent in Spanish and don't know how to dance, either."
"You've only been gone a year." "Just get up, dinosaur. Let me do it. You'll be here all night." Bosch raised his hands in surrender and stood up. She sat down and went to work. Behind her back, Bosch secretly smiled.
"Just like old times," he said. "Don't remind me. I always get the shit work. And stop smiling."
She hadn't looked up from her typing. Her fingers were a blur above the keyboard. Bosch watched in awe.
"Hey, it's not like I planned this. I didn't know you were going to be here."
"Yeah, like Tom Sawyer didn't know he had to paint a fence."
"What? Never mind.
Tell me about the boot."
Bosch was stunned.
"What? Is that all you can say? You heard me. The rookie you're, seeing.
How the hell do you know about it already?"
"I'm a highly skilled gatherer of information, and I still have sources in Hollywood."
Bosch stepped away from her cubicle and shook his head.
"Well? Is she nice?"
"That's all I wanted to know. I don't want to pry."
Bosch came back.
"Yes, she's nice. I hardly know her. You seem to know more about her and me than me."
"You having dinner with her tonight?"
"Yeah, I'm having dinner with her."
"Hey, Harry."
Ryder's voice had lost any note of humor.
"What?"
"You got a pretty good hit here."
Bosch leaned down and looked at the screen. After digesting the information, he said, "I don't think I'm going to make it to dinner tonight."
Chapter 14. Bosch pulled to a stop in front of the house and studied the darkened windows and porch.
"Figures," Edgar said. "The guy ain't even going to be home. Probably already in the wind."
Edgar was annoyed with Bosch, who had called him in from home.
The way he figured it, the bones had been in the ground 20 years. What was the harm of waiting until Monday morning to talk to this guy? But Bosch said he was going by himself if Edgar didn't come in.
Edgar came in.
"No, he's home," Bosch said.
"How do you know?"
"I just know."
He looked at his watch and wrote the time and address down on a page in his small notebook. It occurred to him then that the house they were at was the one where he had seen the curtain pulled closed behind a window on the evening of the first call-out.
"Let's go," he said. "You talk to him the first time, so you take the lead. I'll jump in when it feels right."
They got out and walked up the driveway to the house. The man they were visiting was named Nicholas Trent. He lived alone in the house, which was across the street and 2 houses down from the hillside where the bones had been found. Trent was 57 years old. He had told Edgar during his initial canvass of the neighborhood that he was a set decorator for a studio in Burbank. He was unmarried and had no children. He knew nothing about the bones on the hill and could offer no clues or suggestions that were helpful. Edgar knocked hard on the front door and they waited.
"Mr. Trent, it's the police," he said loudly.
"Detective Edgar, answer your door, please."
He had raised his fist to hit the door again when the porch light went on. The door was then opened, and a white man with a shaved scalp stood in the darkness within. The light from the porch slashed across his face.
"Mr. Trent? It's Detective Edgar. This is my partner, Detective Bosch. We have a few follow-up questions for you, if you don't mind."
Bosch nodded, but didn't offer his hand. Trent said nothing, and Edgar forced the issue by putting his hand against the door and pushing it open.
"All right if we come in?" he asked,
already halfway across the threshold.
"No. It's not all right," Trent said quickly.
Edgar stopped and put a puzzled look on his face.
"Sir, we just have a few more questions we'd like to ask."
"Yeah, and that's bullshit."
"Excuse me?"
"We all know what is going on here. I talked to my attorney already. Your act is just that, an act. A bad one." Bosch could see they were not going to get anywhere with the trick-or-treat strategy. He stepped up and pulled Edgar back by the arm. Once his partner had cleared the threshold, he looked at Trent.
"Mr. Trent, if you knew we'd be back, then you knew we'd find out about your past. Why didn't you tell Detective Edgar about it before? It could have saved us some time. Instead, it gives us suspicion. You can understand that, I'm sure.
Because the past is the past. I didn't bring it up. I buried the past. Leave it that way.
Not when there are bones buried in it, Edgar said in an accusatory tone. Bosch looked back at Edgar and gave him a look that said, use some finesse.
See, Trent said, this is why I am saying, go away. I have nothing to tell you people, nothing. I don't know anything about it.
Mr. Trent, you molested a 9-year-old boy, Bosch said.
The year was 1966, and I was punished for it, severely. It's the past. I've been a perfect citizen ever since. I had nothing to do with those bones up there.
Bosch waited a moment, and then spoke in a calm and quieter tone. If that is the truth, then let us come in and ask our questions. The sooner we clear you, the sooner we move on to other possibilities. But you have to understand something here. The bones of a young boy were found about 100 yards from the home of a man who molested a young boy in 1966. I don't care what kind of citizen he's been since then. We need to ask him some questions. And we will ask those questions. We have no choice. Whether we do it in your home right now or with your lawyer at the station, with all of the news cameras waiting outside, that's going to be your choice. He paused. Trent looked at him with scared eyes. So you can understand our situation, Mr. Trent, and we can certainly understand yours. We're willing to move quickly and discreetly, but we can't without your cooperation. Trent shook his head as though he knew that no matter what he did now, his life as he knew it was in jeopardy and probably permanently altered. He finally stepped back and signaled Bosch and Edgar in. Trent was barefoot and wearing baggy black shorts that showed off thin ivory legs with no hair on them. He wore a flowing silk shirt over his thin upper body. He had the same build as a ladder, all hard angles. He led them to a living room cluttered with antiques. He sat down in the center of a couch. Bosch and Edgar took the two leather club chairs opposite. Bosch decided to keep the lead. He didn't like the way Edgar had handled the door. To be cautious and careful, I'm going to read you your constitutional rights, he said. Then I'll ask you to sign a waiver form. This protects you as well as us. I am also going to record our conversation so that nobody ends up putting words in anybody else's mouth. If you want a copy of the tape, I will make it available. Trent shrugged, and Bosch took it as reluctant agreement. When Bosch had the form signed, he slipped it into his briefcase and took out a small recorder. Once he started it, and identified those present as well as the time and date, he nodded to Edgar to assume the lead again. This was because Bosch thought that observations of Trent and his surroundings were going to be more important than his answers now. Mr. Trent, how long have you lived in this house?
Since 1984.
He then laughed.
What is funny about that? Edgar asked.
1984.
Don't you get it? George Orwell? Big Brother.
He gestured toward Bosch and Edgar as the front man of Big Brother. Edgar apparently didn't follow the statement and continued with the interview.
Rent or own?
Own. At first I rented, then I bought the house in 87 from the landlord.
Okay. And you are a set designer in the entertainment industry?
Set decorator. There is a difference.
What is the difference?
The designer plans and supervises the construction of the set. The decorator then goes in and puts in the details. The little character strokes. The character's belongings or tools. Like that.
How long have you done this?
26 years.
Did you bury that boy up on the hillside?
Trent stood up indignantly.
Absolutely not. I've never even set foot on that hill, and you people are making a big mistake if you waste your time on me when the true killer of that poor soul is still out there somewhere.
Bosch leaned forward in his chair. Sit down, Mr. Trent, he said. The fervent way in which Trent delivered the denial made Bosch instinctively think he was either innocent or one of the better actors he had come across on the job. Trent slowly sat down on the couch again. You're a smart guy, Bosch said, deciding to jump in. You know exactly what we're doing here. We have to bag you or clear you. It's that simple. So why don't you help us out? Instead of dancing around with us, why don't you tell us how to clear you? Trent raised his hands wide.
I don't know how. I don't know anything about the case. How can I help you when I don't know the first thing about it?
Well, right off the bat, you can let us take a look around here. If I can start to get comfortable with you, Mr. Trent, then maybe I can start seeing it from your side of things. But right now, like I said, I've got you with your record, and I've got bones across the street. Bosch held up his two hands as if he was holding those two things in them. It doesn't look that good from where I'm looking at things. Trent stood up and threw one hand out in a gesture toward the interior of the house.
Fine. Be my guest. Look around to your heart's content. You won't find a thing because I had nothing to do with it. Nothing.
Bosch looked at Edgar and nodded, the signal being that he should keep Trent occupied while Bosch took a look around. Thank you, Mr. Trent, Bosch said as he stood up. As he headed into a hallway that led to the rear of the house, he heard Edgar asking if Trent had ever seen any unusual activity on the hillside where the bones had been found.
I just remember kids used to play up.
He stopped. Apparently, when he realized that any mention he made of kids would only further suspicion about him. Bosch glanced back to make sure the red light of the recorder was still on.
Did you like watching the kids play up there in the woods, Mr. Trent? Edgar asked.
Bosch stayed in the hallway, out of sight, but listening to Trent's answer.
No. I couldn't see them if they were up in the woods. On occasion, I would be driving up. Or walking my dog, when he was alive. And I would see the kids climbing up there. The girl across the street. The Fosters next door. All the kids around here. It's a city-owned right-of-way. The only undeveloped land in the neighborhood. So they went up there to play. Some of the neighbors thought the older ones went up there to smoke cigarettes, and the concern was that they would set the whole hillside on fire.
How long ago are you talking about?
Like when I first moved here.
I didn't get involved. The neighbors who had been here took care of it. Bosch moved down the hall. It was a small house, not much bigger than his own. The hallway ended at a conjunction of three doors, bedrooms on the right and left, and a linen closet in the middle. He checked the closet first, found nothing unusual, and then moved into the bedroom on the right. It was Trent's bedroom. It was neatly kept, but the tops of the twin bureaus and bed tables were cluttered with knick-knacks that Bosch assumed Trent used on the job in helping to turn sets into real places for the camera. He looked in the closet. There were several shoe boxes on the upper shelf. Bosch started opening them and found they contained old, worn-out shoes. It was apparently Trent's habit of buying new shoes and putting his old ones in the box, then shelving them. Bosch guessed that these, too, became part of his work inventory. He opened one box and found a pair of work boots. He noticed that dirt had dried hard in some of the treads. He thought about the dark soil where the bones had been found. Samples of it had been collected. He put the boots back and made a mental note of it for the search warrant. His current search was just a cursory look around. If they moved to the next step with Trent and he became a full-fledged suspect, then they would come back with a search warrant and literally tear the place apart, looking for evidence tying him to the bones. The work boots might be a good place to start. He was already on tape saying he had never been up on that hillside. If the dirt in the treads matched the soil samples from the excavation, then they'd have Trent caught in a lie. Most of what sparring with suspects was about was the locking in of a story. It was then that the investigator looked for the lies. There was nothing else in the closet that warranted Bosch's attention. Same with the bedroom or the attached bathroom. Bosch, of course, knew that if Trent was the killer, he'd had many years to cover his tracks. He would also have had the last 3 days, since Edgar first questioned him during the canvas, to double-check his trail and be ready.
The other bedroom was used as an office and a storage room for his work. On the walls hung framed one-sheets, advertising the films Bosch assumed Trent had worked on. Bosch had seen some of them on television, but rarely went to theaters to see movies. He noticed that one of the frames held the one-sheet for a film called The Art of the Cape. Years before, Bosch had investigated the murder of that film's producer. He had heard that after that, the one-sheets from the movie had become collector items in underground Hollywood. When he was finished looking around the rear of the house, Bosch went through a kitchen door into the garage. There were two bays, one containing Trent's minivan. The other was stacked with boxes with markings on them corresponding to rooms in a house. At first, Bosch was shocked at the thought that Trent had still not completely unpacked after moving in nearly 20 years before. Then he realized the boxes were work-related and used in the process of set decoration. When he turned around, he was looking at an entire wall hung with the heads of wild game, their black marble eyes staring at him. Bosch felt a nerve tickle run down his spine. All of his life, he had hated seeing things like that. He wasn't sure why. He spent another few minutes in the garage, mostly going through a box in the stack that was marked Boys' Room 9 to 12. It contained toys, airplane models, a skateboard, and a football. He took the skateboard out for a few moments and studied it, all the while thinking about the shirt from the backpack with Solid Surf printed on it. After a while, he put the skateboard back in the box and closed it. There was a side door to the garage that led to a path that went to the backyard. A pool took up most of the level ground before the yard rose into the steep wooded hillside. It was too dark to see much, and Bosch decided he would have to do the exterior look during daylight hours. Twenty minutes after he left to begin the search, Bosch returned to the living room empty-handed. Trent looked up at him expectantly.
Satisfied?
I'm satisfied for now, Mr. Trent. I appreciate your...
You see? It never ends. Satisfied for now. You people will never let it go, will you? I mean, if I was a drug dealer or a bank robber, my debt would be cleared and you people would leave me alone. But because I touched a boy almost 40 years ago, I am guilty for life.
I think you did more than touch him, Edgar said. But we'll get the records. Don't worry. Trent put his face in his hands and mumbled something about it being a mistake to have cooperated. Bosch looked at Edgar, who nodded that he was finished and ready to go. Bosch stepped over and picked up his recorder. He slid it into the breast pocket of his jacket, but didn't turn it off. He'd learned a valuable lesson on a case the year before. Sometimes the most important and telling things are said after an interview is supposedly over. Mr. Trent, thank you for your cooperation. We're going to go, but we might need to talk to you tomorrow. Are you working tomorrow?
God, no, don't call me at work. I need this job and you'll ruin it. You'll ruin everything.
He gave Bosch his pager number. Bosch wrote it down and headed toward the front door. He looked back at Edgar. Did you ask him about trips? He's not planning to go anywhere, is he? Edgar looked at Trent.
Mr. Trent, you work on movies. You know how the dialogue goes. You call us if you plan to go out of town. If you don't, and we have to find you, you're not going to like it very much.
Trent spoke in a flat-line monotone. His eyes focused forward. Somewhere far away.
I'm not going anywhere at all. Now please leave. Just leave me alone.
They walked out the door and Trent closed it hard behind them. At the bottom of the driveway was a large bougainvillea bush in full bloom. It blocked Bosch's view of the left side of the street until he got there. A bright light suddenly flashed on and in Bosch's face. A reporter, with a cameraman in tow, moved in on the two detectives. Bosch was blinded for a few moments until his eyes started to adjust.
Hi, detectives. Judy Surtain, Channel 4 News. Is there a break in the Bones case?
No comment, Edgar barked. No comment, and turn that damn light off.
Bosch finally saw her in the glare of the light. He recognized her from TV and from the gathering at the roadblock earlier in the week. He also recognized that a no comment was not the way to leave this situation. He needed to defuse it and keep the media away from Trent.
No, he said. No breakthrough. We're just following routine procedures.
Sertain shoved the microphone she was carrying toward Bosch's face.
Why are you out here in the neighborhood again?
We're just finishing the routine canvas of the residents here. I hadn't had a chance to talk to the resident here before. We just finished up, that's all.
He was talking with a bored tone in his voice. He hoped she was buying it.
Sorry, he added. No big story tonight.
Well, was this neighbor or any of the neighbors helpful to the investigation?
Well, everyone here has been very cooperative with us, but as far as investigative leads go, it has been difficult. Most of these people weren't even living in the neighborhood when the bones were buried. That makes it tough.
Bosch gestured toward Trent's house.
This gentleman, for example. We just found out that he didn't buy his home here until 1987, and we're pretty sure those bones were already up there by then.
So then it's back to the drawing board?
Sort of. And that's really all I can tell you. Good night.
He pushed past her toward his car. A few moments later, Sertain was on him at the car door, without her cameraman.
Detective, we need to get your name.
Bosch opened his wallet and took out a business card, the one with the general station number printed on it. He gave it to her and said good night again.
Look, if there is anything you can tell me, you know, off the record, I would protect you, Sertain said.
You know, off camera like this, whatever you want to do.
No, there's nothing, Bosch said as he opened the door. Have a good night.
Edgar cursed the moment the doors of the car were closed.
How the hell did she know we were here?
Probably a neighbor, Bosch said.
She was out here the whole 2 days of the dig. She's a celebrity. She made nice with the residents, made friends. Plus, we're sitting in a goddamn Shamu. Might as well have called a press conference.
Bosch thought of the inanity of trying to do detective work in a car painted black and white.
Under a program designed to make cops more visible on the street, the department had assigned detectives in the divisions to black and whites that didn't carry the emergency lights on top, but were just as noticeable. They watched as the reporter and her cameraman went to Trent's door.
She's going to try to talk to him, Edgar said.
Bosch quickly went into his briefcase and got out his cell phone. He was about to dial Trent's number and tell him not to answer when he realized he couldn't get a cell signal.
God damn it, he said.
Too late anyway, Edgar said. Let's just hope he plays it smart. Bosch could see Trent at his front door, totally bathed in the white light from the camera. He said a few words and then made a waving gesture and closed the door.
Good, Edgar said.
Bosch started the car, turned it around and headed back through the canyon to the station.
So, what's next? Edgar asked.
We have to pull the records on his conviction. See what it was about.
I'll do that first thing.
No. First thing, I want to deliver the search warrants to the hospitals. Whether Trent fits our picture or not, we need to ID the kid in order to connect him to Trent. Let's meet at Van Nuys Courthouse at 8. We get them signed and then split them up.
Bosch had picked Van Nuys Court because Edgar lived nearby, and they could separate and go from there in the morning after the warrants had been approved by a judge.
What about a warrant on Trent's place? Edgar said. You see anything while you were looking around?
Not much. He's got a skateboard in a box in the garage. You know, with his work stuff. For putting on a set. I was thinking of our victim's shirt when I saw that. And there were some work boots with dirt in the treads. It might match the samples from the hill, but I'm not counting on a search coming through for us. The guy has had 20 years to make sure he's clear. If he's the guy.
You don't think so?
Bosch shook his head.
Timing's wrong. 84 is on the late side. The far edge of our window.
I thought we were looking at 75 to 85.
We are.
In general.